It's been said in Soviet Russia that you don't play the game plays you. Governor Haslam has decreed October 19th through the 25th is Friends of the Library Week. So I asked my colleagues, you're friends of the library, right?
Sure.
We jest, but for reals, this week is Friends of the Library Week. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can read the actual declaration by the governor. It's very fancy. It'll be in some archive someday. Our governor's nothing like the governor from The Walking Dead. Just wanted to point that out. Soon, NPL will be streamlining its Friends of the Library's bylaws, and if you wanted to formalize your relationship with your library branch, you can. You can still join your friends group right now if you want to, but that's in the future, on the horizon. Here now, today, all of us are on intimate terms with our libraries. Oh, the stories we could tell. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to tell you about the best books, movies, and music about libraries. And if you're listening, I know you care about libraries. And I know you care about what Bill is going to tell you about what's happening at the library.
Yes, I mentioned it last week on the podcast, but it needs to be mentioned again. Please come to our Movies at Main so we get scary. Well, really, this is more get suspenseful. On Saturday, October 25th, 2014 at 2 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library, 615 Church Street, to see Elizabeth Taylor and Lawrence Harvey in Night Watch. Elizabeth Taylor stars as Ellen Wheeler, a rich widow recovering from a nervous breakdown. One night she, while looking out her window, she witnesses a murder. Will anyone believe her? This is also based on a play by Lucille Fletcher, so please come. It's, once again, October 25th, 2014 at 2 p.m., Night Watch.
Ooh, sounds spooky.
Crystal, can you do a cold open?
So
that's a good one.
Yeah, very cool.
Most producers are like, okay, Dave, go, and then he makes that noise.
Cool yodel.
All right.
Library stuff.
My favorite library in pop culture is Planet Sized. In its endless stacks, the library, which was built in the 50th century, holds a physical copy of every book ever written. This planet-sized library supports its own moon, referred to as Dr. Moon, because it serves as antivirus protection. At the core of the library, you'll find the largest hard drive in the history of hard drives. It runs the index of the library and stores backup copies of all the books. Now, I do have a couple criticisms about this library. First, no real flesh-and-blood librarians work there, only robots with weirdly sculpted limbless bodies featuring faces made out of donated flesh.
Ugh.
Yeah. These robot librarians change faces according to each visitor's comfort level.
I wouldn't want to check them out.
But seriously. And secondly, and most importantly, the deadly shadows that lurk in the halls of this library. More on those shadows later. So where does this ultimate library exist? In the Doctor Who universe, of course. Season 4, Episode 8 of the Doctor Who reboot is titled Silence in the Library.
Shh.
The episode begins with the Doctor, played by David Tennant, taking his current companion, Donna Noble, played by Catherine Tate, to the 51st century to visit the greatest library in the universe. But it's deserted. A little girl holds the key to the abandoned library. This is where you say girl power.
Oh.
Girl power!
Now, remember those deadly shadows I mentioned before? Well, they want to eat people. They're called the Vashta Narada, and they are scarier than any bookworm you'll ever encounter. Now, many things happen in this episode that build upon the Doctor Who mythology, and the attention to storyline continuity is quite amazing. But what sticks with me after watching this episode is the endless shelves of books. Now, if you've never watched Doctor Who, I wouldn't recommend jumping right into this episode, but work yourself up to it. You won't regret it. All right, Mike?
Yeah, I swear that the best starter episode is one of the Weeping Angels, which was pretty cool. And appropriate for Shocktober. Anywho, today I thought I'd talk about a little movie called Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, from 1989, directed by Steven Spielberg. Ooh. So, a personal story. I had no idea until I was accepted into library school that 90% of librarians are female. I had no idea. I didn't really notice. And it doesn't really matter, you know, whatever. But, whenever I think of, librarians beat it, it always kind of strays towards the one dude I can ever think of, which was in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Ooh.
We're about to complete a great quest. The Holy Grail, Dr. Jones.
Oh, rats.
This is it. Look. The shield is the second mark. We found it.
Indiana Jones is on the quest of a lifetime. But for some adventures, one Jones is not enough.
Dad? Junior?
Don't call me that, please.
Follow me! Out of the way!
A race across three continents.
And in this sort of race, there's no silver medal for finishing second.
Hang on, Dad, we're going in!
Into the homeland of the enemy.
Nazis. I hate these guys.
Our situation has not improved.
In his search for the Holy Grail.
How dare you kiss me?
Are you crazy? Don't go between them!
Go between them, are you crazy?
Where's my father?
In the belly of that steel beast.
Dad! Junior!
You call this archaeology?
The quest for the Grail is not archaeology. It's a race against evil.
Germany has declared war on the Jones boys.
Those people are trying to kill us.
I know, Dad!
It's a new experience for me.
Happens to me all the time.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Have the adventure of your life. Keeping up with the Joneses.
So Last Crusade is about Indy's search for the Holy Grail. Turns out that the Holy Grail was his father Henry's obsession. And Indy spent much of his youth overseas while his father searched through libraries and tombs. To be honest, the plot is kind of meh if you think about it for too long. But it's more of a fun turn off your brain romp, that I personally enjoy. Probably because I saw it about a billion times as a kid. The action's cool, set pieces. I really love the father-son dynamic, especially the bit where, Indy and his father are, chatting in the Zeppelin, You left, just as you were getting interesting. There's a scene about a fourth of the way through the film where Indy and his cohorts go to Venice to see a medieval church that had been converted into a library. As an aside, I found that kind of amusing because most ancient buildings in Italy only survive today because they've been converted into churches. It is there that Indy finds a tomb of an ancient crusader by slamming a post through the marble floor with a giant Roman numeral for 10, or X. He previously made a joke in the film that an archaeology X never ever marks the spot. There's a male Italian librarian who looks a lot like Albert Einstein stamping books that the camera occasionally pans to. And as Indy slams this post into the ground, it is also coincidentally timed with the librarian stamping the books. And he becomes so bewildered by this crazy loud noise that he puts the stamp down confusion and just kind of stares at it blankly. So I have to stamp papers every day as part of my job. So sometimes I kind of picture the thunk, thunk every time I like a...
You know, we used to have a library tool called the Thunker.
Ooh. Oh, we did. This is true.
Ooh. Wow.
Anyway.
It made a big
thunk. It was a weapon that the security used.
Cool. That's right. Lastly, I thought I'd mention that when I made a post on Facebook ages ago when I got this job, a friend of mine sent me a Penny Arcade cartoon where Gabriel's surprised that there are male librarians at all. He even assumes that the word librarian denotes gender, like sorceress, and comes up with some amusing masculine alternatives. I've got it hanging up in my office. I will send Brian a link to it so you can enjoy it yourself. What have you got today, Bill?
Interior, public library, main library late night. The character Somerset, all these books, gentlemen, a world of knowledge at your disposal, and you play poker all night long. Janitor, we got culture. Guard, yeah, we got culture coming out of asses. At this point, the guard hits play on a boombox. Guard, how's this for culture? The boombox plays Suite Number 3 in D major by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Never heard of him.
In the next montage, you see Somerset researching Dante's Purgatory, the Canterbury Tales, the Parson's Tale, and Dictionary of Catholicism. The scene is from Seven, starring Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, written by Andrew Kevin Walker, and directed by David Finchner.
Do you like what you do for a living? These things you see?
You have to wear blinders sometimes. Most times.
You're retiring. 6 more days and you're all the way gone.
So how long have you lived here?
Too long.
We'll be spending every waking hour together from now until the time I leave. I'll show you who your friends and enemies are.
Look, I've worked homicide 5 years, not here.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have ourselves a homicide.
No fingerprints and no witnesses of any kind.
Nope. About the only thing we know about that guy right now is he's totally insane.
There are 7 deadly sins. Gluttony.
You're going to come take a look at this.
Greed.
No one touches anything.
Sloth, wrath, pride, lust, and envy. 7. You can expect 5 more of these.
Body was found on Tuesday morning.
I hate this city.
We're going to get who did this.
This will be the very definition of swift justice.
There are 2 more bodies, 2 more victims.
This guy's methodical, exacting, and worst of all, patient.
He's laughing at us.
He had a gun.
He's 2 murders away from completing his masterpiece.
Hey!
Let's finish it.
Seven has another library connection. Before book discussions, I think this is before any of y'all were hired, too. Chris goes back. Crystal and I know this story. Before book discussions, the library would pick once a month a movie to discuss. And one of the movies selected was Seven. And we had a nice-sized crowd for the discussion. Of course, the movie Seven is about us hunt for a serial killer. And on that particular movie discussion, we had an actual serial killer show up. Maybe not a serial killer. Let's just say he wasn't all there.
Oh.
It was so weird. Everybody was huddled in one corner, and in the other corner was this serial killer dude chomping one of Crystal's cookies that she provided for the evening.
True story.
That's good. Bribe a serial killer. Yeah. Excellent plan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm in the middle. In the movie. In the movie Seven, one of the neat things that happens is certain books are marked when people check them out repeatedly from the library. And Somerset, played by Morgan Freeman, pays off this shadowy government official to get the information. During the discussion, Crystal made the joke, "Don't worry, we don't do that here at the library." Then serial killer guy chimes in and says, "Oh, yes, you do, because I read about it in a book on the 3rd floor."
Awkward silence.
He didn't give us the title of the book, and we didn't ask because, well, we were scared. And to end this epic story, as soon as the movie discussion was over, everybody left. I've never seen a room clear out so fast in my life, except for serial killer guy who was eating Crystal's cookies. So check out Seven from the library And you can take it and watch it in the safety of your own home.
I came back later and started working at the library. Yeah,
So I'm tossing it to you, Amanda.
I'm sorry, I'm a serial killer guy. Not really.
About the Bill's serial killer story, that experience was an outlier, and that most programs at the library are really fun, really peaceful, safe, and welcoming, and that me and Crystal both host book clubs at the library that people come to and are fun. And at Crystal's book club, there's often snacks. And these movies...
Yeah, tasty snacks. We had a cake once. It was great.
And these movies that Bill tells you about, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, they're only scary if the movie's scary. And, you know, like, nothing's going to happen like in Ghostbusters unless we're making a commercial that day. I just wanted to put that out there.
So Mike and I, for those of you that don't know, Mike and I work in the basement. And some days it can be scary. But luckily, we have never seen vertical book stacking. And the card catalog has never attacked us.
Yet.
So, yeah, well, that's true. Although our card catalog is digital at this point, so we might get rowdy if...
Cyber war.
I'm in charge of the card catalog. Or one of them.
So it might attack me yet. You. Yeah. Yeah, so I say I don't
That's why I say yet. Yeah.
Of course, I'm going to talk about the 1984 blockbuster hit, Ghostbusters, which does double duty as, you know, this is probably the scariest movie I've ever seen. That just tells you where my head's at with that.
Ghosts.
Hello, Ghostbusters.
They're real.
You do?
They're mean.
You have?
They're here.
We got one!
Ghostbusters.
Hey, anybody see a ghost?
They catch the ghost that won't stay dead. They're armed. They're dangerous.
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
All right, that's bad. Okay. All right, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
They're professionals.
Oh. I'm the chairman of the largest paranormal removal company in America.
Did you see it?
They're all that stands between you and the end of the world.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
Real wrath of God type stuff. Fire and brimstone coming down from the sky.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Your girlfriend lives in the corner penthouse of Spook Central.
You want this body?
Is this a trick question?
Play a stick.
Hold.
Beat him up.
Smoke it.
Make him hard.
Ready.
Ghostbusters. Starring Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Harold Ramis, Rick Moranis. Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters.
We came, we saw, we kicked it.
Of course, the beginning of the movie starts in the basement of the New York Public Library with the poor librarian that's trying to shelve books. The ghost comes at her and scares her, and thus begins our story. Written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, it actually started as a project for him and John Belushi, who was going to play Peter Venkman, but then unfortunately, you know, Belushi passed away. They had to, you know, go back and rechange the whole entire script, and they were trying to get John Candy in, too. He was going to be Louis Tully, but he never would commit to the film, so they kind of rewrote it, and that became, you know, a good role for Rick Moranis. So Ghostbusters star Dan Aykroyd as Ray Stantz, Harold Ramis as Egon Spengler, Bill Murray as Peter Venkman, and then we pick up Ernie Hudson.
Winston Zeddemore.
Thank you. All I could think of was Winston. And then Sigourney Weaver is the love interest, and Annie Potts is the delightful secretary. That's one of my favorite roles. I love her part, especially as it changes as she goes into the second movie. The theme song for the movie was actually number one on the Billboard Hot 100, and they made a video. It was all over MTV.
Who you gonna call?
That was Ghostbusters! And so they had this call and response with
Ray
all
Parks
these people.
Jr., I believe.
Ray Parker Jr. Yeah, but so John Candy finally got his butt together and, you know, made it for a cameo in the video. And so we also saw Chevy Chase, George Wendt, Al Franken, Carly Simon showed up. So it's pretty big, and I mean... to all of us this day know that song. So in 1989, they finally were talked into making a sequel, Ghostbusters 2, which Mike and I were talking about that we like.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you like it better than the first one?
Well, no, but you know, yeah. It's still good.
Because I think I saw the second one first, just because of.
Okay.
And then I went back and saw the first one because there's that line where Lewis Tully goes, "Cause one time I turned into a dog and they helped me. Thank you." And I was like, "What?" Like I didn't get that. So. You know, because I was like 10, I didn't know.
Yeah, I wanted to. My sister watched Mary Poppins, I believe, 80 or 90 times one summer. So I was going to beat her. So I watched Ghostbusters over 100 times.
Nice.
So when it came to the theaters earlier this year, I could predict music cues, every word they're about to say.
Yeah.
You know, every scene, I mean, it was my head was about 2 seconds ahead of everything that was about to happen. It was kind of neat.
And the people around you wanted to punch you.
There was a father and son in front of me. And when it ended, the dad was like, "So what'd you think?" And the son was like, "Eh." And I was like, if he was my son, I would have no son. You're walking to your house, child. Anyway.
Yeah, because the movie did come back out in the theaters this last, was it summer? It was,
about a month ago.
Okay, because this is the 30th anniversary. Yeah.
And right now, Krispy Kreme has commemorative Ghostbusters donuts. Yes.
I'll be right back.
Yeah.
Should I bring you one?
My sister has been calling and or texting me every other day going, "You need to go get these."
Yeah, and we should also mention that they're talking about working on Ghostbusters 3, but we did lose Harold Ramis this past February, which was sad. And so I don't know. I mean, I know that we were talking Ivan Reitman's not going to be in it, where they're trying to get Bill Murray. So I don't know if this is going to be a viable project or
last I heard, it's going to be an all-female edition. So
that's scary.
It's going to be directed by Paul Feig, who did Bridesmaids and The Heat.
Okay, I like Bridesmaids.
And they're casting right now. I mean, we're talking about Gillian Anderson wants to be in it. And I've also heard it could be even a remake, which would be interesting. I'd like to see a female remake.
That might be more interesting than just a Ghostbusters 3.
Yeah.
So anyway, Ghostbusters, don't be afraid of your library basement. There are proton packs that will protect you.
Funny, just like that movie is like totally imprinted on my young brain too. I haven't seen it 100 times, but like that scene at the beginning, the very opening scene in the library scared the crap out of me when I was a kid, right?
And then, the bit where Sigourney Weaver is sitting on the chair and those hands come and grab her and turn her around and the dog is in the kitchen. To this day, it still kind of creeps me out.
Yeah, I still can't watch that.
It's a little kid that
okay.
Just, you know.
I need help because there was some comedy troupe that did the prank on the New York Public Library where they ran through and like sheets
everywhere.
On. Okay.
I saw that.
I was trying to find who that was and I couldn't find it.
Yeah, because people were running in like...
Everybody was sitting there studying. Yeah, the sheets came through first and then like you saw the Ghostbusters...
Yeah, then they were dressed as Ghostbusters running after them. And you could see reactions of normal people who had
like,
no idea what was going on.
Studying,
going like,
yeah.
What the what? Like, as they're running very quietly.
And I guess New York Public Library was in on it because they let them do it and didn't...
It was an ad for the New York Public Library.
Okay, that was enjoyable.
I met Harold Ramis once.
At
the Virginia Film Festival, and it was kind of, he was there for a movie called The Iced Harvest with John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton, and he introduced it, and later the movie, I was kind of bummed because there wasn't question and answers afterwards, and we were walking out, and he's the only filmmaker that's ever done this. He was greeting people.
Mm.
And I wasn't going to say anything, but it just inadvertently, I wound up staring right in his face, and I just said, "I enjoyed your film. Thank you." That was it.
Aww.
Egon told you, thank you.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I guess, you know, I'm a snob. I always go meta. I apologize. I wanted to tell you about this nonfiction book by James Gleick called The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. So it's the history of information, like, as a thing. And now, of course, you just said, "I do not care, man. I'm going to go watch cartoons. That's so boring."
Well, yeah.
But...
There's a Ghostbuster cartoon.
I want to say that...
There is, with Dave Coulier.
I want to say that James Gleick is a really, really good science writer. He's, like, you know, considered one of the best science writers. And what he does is he makes dry things, boring things, really, really interesting. And this is the case with The Information. And I really liked the first half of the book better because it was about, like, what starts out with, like, drumming, how, like, people would actually, like, use drums or music to convey information. Then it talked about how in ancient history there was actually this huge debate... How when writing started, how a lot of scholars and people felt that, you know, that knowledge would be lost because of writing. And they lost that argument, and actually their opinions are probably known because of writing, because people wrote down what they thought. I like those parts better. There's this big divide of what happens, right? And that is computers, because after computers, we can save, like, more and more information. So after computers happen, Well, we can compute more information and save more and more information. So it's like, this is what the flood is about, because all of a sudden now in the 20th century, we have tons and tons more of information than we ever knew before, and more things that we've ever known. Ever.
Yeah, isn't it like the incomplete like information from human history doubles every like 6 months now?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is just bonkers.
And that is because of computers. And he starts talking about the history of computing and its effects. And I think he gets a little blurry in what the themes of the book are. Like after in that second half, I mean, the first half was more interesting because I didn't know that there was a debate in ancient culture about written knowledge versus oral knowledge. That was like really fascinating.
Yeah, that's what I heard that Socrates, that he didn't believe in writing. He thought everything should be like between, you know, a chat, a dialogue, which is why the only things we all know about him is from Plato, because he wrote stuff down.
Way to go, Socrates.
Socrates. Heard they're making a third one of that, too.
Ha! Socrates.
Scared.
You were wrong, Socrates. You're always right in all those books, but you were wrong.
One.
So the book actually changed the way that I thought about Wikipedia. And so I just wanted to put that, like, I wonder, like, how you guys feel about Wikipedia.
I don't know. I really should just, like, not trust it as much as I do. But if I'm, like, in a rush or something, or I just want to know, like, basic information about something I just learned about. I like Wikipedia. But if it's something that I want to know more about or want to really get into, I go to, like, actual books written by scholars.
Yeah, I feel like it's a good place to start. Like, if you just heard of something, like, what in the world? And then you wiki it and figure out, well, and then, like you said, it gives you better sources that can get you accurate and up-to-date information.
Good basic information, too. Like when I try to get in touch with directors and things, it gives you, which I need, ages, spouses, mm-hmm. you know, just when I'm looking in the white pages to make sure I've got the right person I'm looking for. And I've also used it for, you know, just background information. But yeah, like you said, I probably trust it a little bit more than I should.
It actually made me think about Wikipedia in a different way. And I've actually come to think that Wikipedia is not only like a good general purpose encyclopedia, I actually think that Wikipedia is like one of the greatest accomplishments of our species ever. Like Great Wall of China, atomic bomb, maybe that's not an accomplishment arguably, but name it, Seven Wonders of the World, the Pyramids, Wikipedia.
Frostflakes.
And
it's all you milk.
In 2008, Wikipedia had exponentially more entries than all of the printed encyclopedias in the history of the world combined, and it was in exponentially more languages. And I think some of the critiques of Wikipedia are actually some of its strengths. There actually gets to be a consensus about contested subjects when people can't agree, so then it becomes actually very generalist as opposed to being specific. So these sort of edit wars that break out are actually very helpful to Wikipedia. And the examples whenever whenever famous people complain about there's wrong information on Wikipedia about them, there's actually, for me, that just says more about their ego than it does about the accuracy of Wikipedia. There have been many, many studies about the accuracy of Wikipedia, and what they find is Wikipedia's inaccuracy rate is just slightly, you know, a percent point or two higher than other print sources. Some medical and pharmacological schools have done studies about whether their reference textbooks have their accuracy of, like, medical reference textbooks versus Wikipedia. Their conclusion is that Wikipedia is a fine general source, the same that we all said. And we all use it many, many times a day, mm-hmm. all the time. This was, it's the fifth globally amongst all websites with 18 billion page views and nearly 500 million unique visitors a month. That's insane. That means everyone all over the world is looking at Wikipedia all the time. And this thing in science fiction where, like, you go up to the magic computer and you say, magic computer, tell me about bunny rabbits. And the magic computer, there is such a thing. It's called Wikipedia. It exists now. We created it. And even better, it's a nonprofit organization. It's all done by volunteers. It's an amazing accomplishment that humanity has ever done. I love that Wikipedia exists. And it's really just cool. It amazes me.
I feel like the brilliance of Wikipedia is in the format. Because, I don't know, you guys might have had, like, when we were little, we had a World Book Encyclopedia from 1990. Which is great until about 1995. Mm-hmm. Then everything, you know, all the current stuff in it is, you can't, like, just update it. And here's your update. You know, I mean, that's why Wikipedia, I think, really has taken off, is because it's so easy to update. Like, something to change in a day, and they can get it on Wikipedia. You don't have to buy 26 new volumes of books.
The other thing is the software that just makes Wikipedia run is, for the most part, well-designed. Even if you have a slow or crappy internet connection, you can still use Wikipedia, and I think in today's world that's very, very important. Because the other thing that it does, I think, that matters is access. So if you have internet at all or a public library with internet, go public libraries, usually the only free internet service provider in a community or urban or rural, right? You can use Wikipedia and find out information. This idea of like access, where before you were probably a kid who had one and a set of encyclopedias that was like 10 years old.
1976.
Yes. So
that was a good year.
So here for me, this is the test. One of the criticisms is that the actual number of people that edit Wikipedia is actually pretty small compared to the number of people who use it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you know about open source, crowdsource projects, be it software or things like Wikipedia, that's usually how it works. That's usually how it works, and even proprietary for profit. Usually people are in charge, do a lot of the work, right? What my experience, though, is that websites, even very popular ones, like ebb and flow. So I'm curious where Wikipedia is going to be in 10 years, where it's going to be in 20 years. Like, what happens when the people who run Wikipedia now are not running Wikipedia anymore, if there's different people, if it'll have the same values, or if people will use it in a different way, or people will stop adding to it or editing it, or it'll get lax. But right now, Wikipedia, blowing my mind.
Have you edited on Wikipedia?
No.
I never have either.
Well, one of the programs that I wanted to run, and I didn't do this yet at the library because I'm too busy editing this podcast, is I want to do like Wikipedia edit-a-thons. A lot of people do this, where you just have a day where you hang out and you eat bad food and you edit Wikipedia articles, usually about one subject. So that's a library program that I want to have. And
maybe Ghostbusters.
Right? Oh, yeah. You got this wrong.
So I want to do that. But anyway, Wikipedia and also the information by James Gleick, it actually, you know, all this sort of these big platitudes that I like to get excited about, he doesn't say these things, but the facts in his writing about Wikipedia that he wrote about made me have this revelation about Wikipedia.
Tickling my fancy, I'll be brief. I just wanted to say the fifth season of The Walking Dead has started, and let me tell you, the first episode kicked off in overdrive. It's on AMC Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. We have the first four seasons in our collection. Getting back to the first episode, it was called No Sanctuary. And I'll just say, buddy, that's the truth. It was great. It was heavy metal. And I was reading online that the season five opener shattered cable records and even outdid football. So, once again, The Walking Dead. Crystal.
Tickling my fancy this week is actor Shia LaBeouf.
What?
Okay.
I'm going to walk out now.
Let me tell you why. In a recent visit to Jimmy Kimmel's talk show, he hilariously recounts his run-in with the law, which began with drinking copious amounts of whiskey, watching a World Cup match, feeding an older lady strawberries, and grabbing Alan Cumming's leather-clad bottom. I think he almost redeemed himself of idiocy. I don't care if the story he told Kimmel was crafted and rehearsed under the direction of his publicist. It was a brilliantly funny piece of art, and you can see it on YouTube. Amanda?
Ooh. You hear that? What is that? Those are keys to my new office! Yay! So I mentioned earlier, Mike and I work in the basement, but Interlibrary Loan will be moving to the third floor of the library. Yay! I don't know if we'll be completely moved by the time this posts, but we are definitely in the progress of moving. So if you use Interlibrary Loan, feel free to come see us, because they're letting me out of the basement.
Run, Amanda. Save yourself.
Bye, Mike. Ryan.
Yeah, I was going to say the grass is always greener on the other side. I was going to talk about the Anna Nicole opera. It was awesome.
Do we have it?
Yes.
Did we decide that? Okay, I need to watch it, too.
We have it. And we mentioned it in passing, and it was so good, I actually used it on the picture for the opera episode.
Yeah, nice. I noticed that was an interesting picture, yes.
Well, I was like, I actually hate myself because I actually just did that for clicks, and I'm just like, wow, I just put up, like, sexist, I just put up boobs for clicks, and now I hate myself. I thought I would never do that.
You're part of the system.
But
masculine patriarchy.
But the opera is seriously good. I was surprised, and you know this issue of like, oh, I watched it, and it wasn't entertaining? No, it's really funny. It's really dirty. It's more like Rocky Horror, though it is an opera. They sing in operatic style. The music is orchestral but upbeat. And I think it's important to note that it was actually a British production. It's actually sort of a critique of American culture that was really refreshing. The only kind of thing that I kind of like criticism might have of it is it's really funny and satirical, but then like the second act, there's a lot of tragic things that happen, like really sad things. I just don't think that those sad things had the emotional impact that they would have had since the first part was so light in tone. So that kind of was, off-putting for me. So I think there were times when you were really supposed to be tragic and sad, and I couldn't go there because the first half was so irreverent.
Did she wear a pink tracksuit that she always used to wear on that TV show?
There's some sweatsuits. I don't know if there's, like, pink sweatsuits.
That's what she always used to have on that reality show, is that pink velour tracksuit.
I was just going to say, like...
Spoiler, does she die?
I just want to say that it's beyond. Like, whatever you thought, like, what they would make it be... It's beyond. And actually, the character of the old businessman, the old oil man that she marries, like, his character is so interesting. And the character of her mother, so interesting. I think they steal the show.
Her attorney was Howard K. Stern. Anyway, I know too much about this that I don't really care about. Today, I thought I'd talk about a spooky Halloween bag of fun-sized delights. Woo! So if you, like me, only like cereals that are marketed to children, I would run, not walk, to your local grocery store and stock up on monster cereals as fast as you can. Everybody who knows me knows that I have an almost fanatical devotion to the wonder that is Frosted Flakes, as I mentioned earlier, one of the most perfect inventions known to man. A couple years ago, on whim, I tried Frankenberry. Since I'd never had that as a kid, I found a cereal that could almost dethrone Frosted Flakes from its mighty perch. This is the greatest breakfast food ever created in the history of mankind. Normally, whenever I try a new cereal, my tongue slaps it away in disgust. We have tasted perfection itself! You dare poison me with this unworthy slush? But he was totally silent and appreciated Frankenberry's mix of strawberry flavored marshmallows and ghost-shaped floaty bits. So for the past couple of years, Tony goes into High Tiger Nation in October as a gorge on strawberry-ish goodness. But beware, listeners. Last year, I went on Halloween Day, and every grocery store was completely out. And the year before, I went on the day after Halloween, and they were totally gone too. So this year, I'm going to stock up on Holy Frankenberry at least by the 25th.
About corrections. There are no corrections.
Not one?
Sort of, not really.
Cool.
There are nitpicks. The Royal Opera House of London, I just pulled the of London part out of the air, but...
Not of Edinburgh.
Well, it actually is in London, but I don't know why I said of London. I mean, maybe just because I knew it was in London and I was thinking about it. It was founded by John Rich. No, not that John Rich.
Nice.
Oh, that's fun.
In 1728, then it was known as the Theatre Royal at Covent Garden. I don't think they called it Royal. The first work that Rich commissioned was, anybody want to take a guess, commissioned 1728?
Could it be The Beggar's Opera by John Gay?
We have a winner.
Ding, ding,
it
ding,
was
ding.
The Beggar's Opera by John Gay. Now, good transition. You know, this maybe isn't a correction, but when I went back and listened to the episode, I think it was a little ambiguous. You were talking about, you were just reading like the libretto, like
yes.
As a text, right?
Yes.
And there was music written at the time by Johann Papusch, or Papusch? I don't know how to say his name.
Say that one more time.
Papusch?
Papusch?
Yeah, I remember reading in the introduction that there's a version you could read with the music, and but I didn't read that one because I can't read music. So.
But over the years, many people have adapted different music to the libretto, and like the one I think that we know now is the one that you talked about with the music by Benjamin Britten. And if we did make mistakes that need corrections, just give us some feedback. Leave it on the elf. Leave it on the elf. They'll come and tell me. Leave it on the off-the-shelf blog, on iTunes, graffiti, and bathroom stalls for a good time. Go to...
Wow.
For a good time, you can go to...
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by...
Adam Dean.
We'll be right back.
is coming your way. How about a monster for breakfast today? Thanks. And how about some wonderful Frankenberry cereal with oodles and oodles of strawberry-flavored marshmallows? And Frankenberry is part of this good, nutritious breakfast.
Here comes Count Chocula.
Wish you could stay. How about a monster for breakfast today?
Hey! Pop, pop, pop,